Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
Welcome back. We're into the second hour of Wednesday's 9 till noon show. It's Halloween tomorrow. Maybe you've got a spooky story to share. Why not? Get in touch. 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. But we'll catch up on some of your comments coming in so far this morning. I'm a foster parent in Donegal, says this listener, and I totally understand where Jack is coming from. We've had so many children in crisis who we've tried to help. It starts with smoking, cannabis, then it moves on to cocaine. All types of drugs are so freely available on our streets. Secondary schools are full of them. It starts small and then end up in debt and need to sell it. Many of them are taking prescription drugs, anything to get their high. The foster care support is great, but when they turn aged 18, you're given government money and many of them cannot control the use of it, and they end up spending it on drugs and drink. It's so frightening what's happening in Donegal. And that comes from someone in the foster care services. Greg, you asked the question, was there corporal punishment in your school? There was corporal punishment in every school, even up to the late 80s. That's the way it was then, and there's nothing one can do now about it. Yeah, I know. Sorry, maybe I come across as naive in that question. I was kind of looking maybe if people wanted to share their experiences or their views on it, not to sort of suggest it wasn't prevalent in all schools, most schools at the very least. On that point, when I was 5 or 6, I was slapped with a ruler across the chest. I ended up with lumps across my chest because I was hit so hard. I don't even know what I did wrong. The teacher used to pour boiling water over me and dunk me into an enamel basin. People were made to wear dunce hats and were called stupid. We used to walk barefoot to school. It was 9 miles back in those days. We couldn't afford basic necessities, but we got through. Can you imagine being 5 or 6 years of age, slapped across the chest with a ruler, boiling water poured over you and dunked into an enamel basin? I mean, that's... Back in the day, you wouldn't dare make a complaint re a teacher, says a listener. In a lot of cases, your parents would have taken the side of the teacher. If you went to the Garda station, you would have been told to go home and wouldn't have been taken seriously. I went to a mixed school in the Northwest in the early 80s for 3 years after relocating for another part of the country or from another part of the country. Looking back on my 3 years there, the principal had problems with me. He was a madman. His way with dealing with things was with his hands. He had huge hands and used them on many occasions on his pupils. How he got away with it, I'll never know. But back then, you didn't go up against the teacher, especially not the principal. And what's the motivation, do you think, for those actions at that time? Do you believe, I wonder, and I suppose one hat doesn't fit all, but do you believe that they believed they were doing the right thing, that this was in their minds childcare? Or do you think that they had other personality traits, and this was a way of acting out on those, that they derived some sort of a pleasure from beating children or punishing children? And to be honest with you, pouring boiling water over someone, that sounds more like torture than punishment. But what do you think the motivation was? Or maybe you have an insight into it. Let us know. Hey, on the violence at school, we were battered there and battered at home. Such a culture of violence, it's hard to know which done the damage. That comes in from an anonymous listener. I know every contact with us is anonymous, by the way, unless you choose otherwise. But their life was being battered at school and then battered once they got home. What was the motivation? Why would someone do that, I wonder? On this day, I'll come back to that. There are cars speeding through Castle Finn. A couple of people mentioning this, by the way. There's nothing to stop them speeding. There are sheds to keep bikes dry, but nothing for people waiting on a bus. People will end up getting knocked down. Just listening to the headline that there's a shortage of 80,000 workers in the building sector. It's not just building, it's across various sectors, but maybe you're right, actually. Well, Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty stated on your show when outlining their social and affordable housing plan that there is no shortage of workers. In fact, he said that builders are laying off workers. That is, in fact, what he said. It also transpires that banks are unlikely to lend to potential buyers of their social houses. These are Sinn Féin's social houses, due to the fact that under the Sinn Féin plan, the state retains ownership of the land and services under the house. Pierce and the gang are not only out of touch with the electorate, they're out of touch with reality. And, you know, we'll have a series of debates and conversations, and I suppose that'll really kick off. I mean, we're keeping an eye on things at the moment, but once we know that it is November 29th, obviously, we can start teasing this stuff out. Right, okay. Let me see. On this day, October 30th, 1974, 50 years ago, Ireland 3, USSR 0 in Dalyman. John Giles took over as player-manager. Don Givens had a hat-trick and Liam Brady's debut at 18. I wonder if many listeners remember or attended a great year overall with Holland, Germany at the World Cup. Finn Hobbs won the FAI Cup and Donegal won the second Ulster title v Down. That's all in 1974. Wow, what great memories. And by the way, we love as well on this show, you know, we do cover obviously, you know, current affairs and matters that are important right now and into the future. But also we love having chats. You know, we loved our chat with Jack. I hope it was helpful to him. I hope it might be helpful to others. But also if you want to reflect on this day, 50 years ago, 74, Ireland 3, Russia 0. Were you there? 086 60 25,000. One on US politics before we head to a break. Kamala Harris is in full panic mode at the moment. Her supporters had staged the first successful palace insurrection in US history, throwing Joe Biden under the bus, but no one will ever be prosecuted for this palace coup. And what Raymond's talking to here is just back to that. Like, I remember having a conversation with, I think it was Seamus Gunn, and it was just, in fact, it was whilst Joe Biden was contesting the US presidency, and we actually talked about it subsequently. I presumed that the plan was that, and this is, there was nothing for me to base this on other than instinct. I presumed the planning was that he would win the presidency. They would spend the next 3 or 4 years introducing Kamala to the American public or whatever, and then that would be the natural transition. I thought he was a transitional president, to be honest with you, to replace him with Kamala 4 years later. As it turned out, during that period of time, she seemingly was non-existent. Maybe in the US sense they knew, but nationally she was non-existent. But then, in fairness, Raymond, Joe Biden did start to give the impression that he would not be fit for the campaign. Certainly wouldn't be fit for another 4 or 5 years in office. So whilst you describe it as a palace coup, personally, I think it became so obvious that he was incapable of running the campaign as someone might need to. We all get older, and he's still a very strong and I presume intelligent person, but there comes a point where we lose our edge, and he'd lost his edge. But anyway, you think it's a palace coup. And I'll read on here. Harris just stopped running TV adverts this week in North Carolina, indicating that Kamala has given up any hope of winning the state. North Carolina is a small but critical swing state in the election. Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin are the most important swing states. Polls are now indicating that Arizona and New Mexico may go to Trump by a slim margin, critical swing states that Trump had lost last time. Harris simply could not bring herself to break from Biden on any policy issue of any importance, and that includes, most importantly, Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon, and that will probably cost Harris the presidential election. I believe, Raymond, that the margin is going to be wider than people expect. Will it go to Kamala? Will it go to Trump? I have no clue. To be honest with you, I'm not sure anyone does. There's so many variables when people are trying to analyze the figures in these swing states. You know, what candidates were there, what candidates weren't, who might have motivated to vote, who might not be motivated to vote, who can get them out, and all that type of stuff. And I think it's still very much up for grabs. I just think it's going to be wider. I think it's going to be wider than people anticipate, albeit at the moment it's statistically a dead heat. I still don't know, the Americans can argue back and forth who's better for their country. From my perspective, I'm more focused on this country and also what's happening in Ukraine and the Middle East and beyond, and I just don't know which of those two would be better for the world. Also, it's such a toxic space, US politics. Like, X really now is just a US platform. If you're watching on, all it is I remember a time sort of when, you know, things like the awful weather that's hitting Spain at the moment, like you'd almost go to place for information like that would be Twitter, because it did feel like a reliable source and you got news first. Now it's just seemingly the content is just Democrats or Republicans twisting the other person's words, views or polls to suit their narrative. It's like the election is being fought out as to who won it before the fact. It's remarkable, but it's made that platform The only thing I'll go to it is to see how crazy people are getting into, is to try and get their point of view across. All right, okay, sorry, I'm rattling a wee bit there. Any views, or if you want to chat on any of that stuff, get in touch with us, 086 60 25,000. Maybe you want to send, and I know it could be tough for some people, all right, because maybe you're thinking about these things for the first time in a while or ever, but maybe you want to reflect on what life was like in school for you when corporal punishment was a norm. How did it affect you? What was your experience? Maybe you do have an insight into what motivated the teachers that were abusive at that time. Do they believe they were doing the right thing? Or was there something else happening, some other interests in their life that they were playing out through this type of treatment? Or maybe you have a view on who you would like to see win the United States elections. Or maybe you want to just opine on something that's important to you. The numbers remain the same. I'll give you a quick run through of them. WhatsApps and texts, 086 60 25,000. Calls, 074 91 25,000. Now, Life After and the Northwest Road Safety Partnership have partnered with a number of agencies to host an event on November 16th in the Guildhall Square. It runs from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. We'll talk to you in a moment as to what it's all about and what might be seen there. After I welcome Debbie Mullen, who is the chair of Life After, onto the programme. Good morning to you, Debbie. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Greg, for having me and inviting me along.
No, it's really important. How are you keeping? Everything okay with you?
Yeah, it's already been a busy morning here. So, I'm keeping well. Thank you.
Right. Now, and I'm really very sad to hear this. You lost your son, Aaron, in a road traffic collision. He was coming back home from work in Dublin.
No, sorry. No, sorry, that wasn't me. I lost my son, Keelan.
I beg your pardon. That's another person, perhaps, that was also due to join us. No disrespect to your beautiful son, by the way.
No, absolutely.
Talk to me about that, if you don't mind.
So I lost my son, Keelan, in a road traffic collision in 2013. He was 17 years old, and he had just passed his driving test on my birthday on the 1st of February. And then, unfortunately, on the 2nd of March, Keelan was travelling into Limavady for a crusty loaf of bread for breakfast and unfortunately hit black ice and couldn't control his car. And he hit an oncoming tractor and a slurry tank, and he was killed instantly. So as you can imagine, that was truly life-changing and devastating for us as a family at that time.
And at what point then did Life After come, and why do you think it's so important?
Okay, so I suppose then I was invited to a meeting in 2017 in Cookstown, and it was a think tank meeting ran by the emergency services, really looking at what was missing from support and emergency services. And one of the things that was most definitely missing was specialised support services within this area. And at that meeting, I met a guy, Christopher Sherrod, who had lost his father on the Glensheen Pass. And he had set up a Facebook page trying to see if there was other people out there who was interested in coming on board and seeing what how they could support each other. And Christopher asked me to come along to his first meeting, which again was to gather up momentum to find out who would be interested. And from that, we formed a committee, and he asked me to come on board with that. So I was one of Christopher is the founding member, and I was one of the five families initially that came on board.
And what was your motivation for saying, OK? I mean, obviously, because you would have gone through this and were going through this, you would recognise the gaps that were there. But sort of what in you thought, right, you know, I'm going to dedicate, you know, a significant part of my time in establishing this, being a founding member, having it grow?
Well, I suppose professionally I'm a counsellor, therapeutic counsellor, and I'm very aware that what is needed in the aftermath of a fatal road traffic collision, and that is support. What I do know is there are nice guidelines here within the North. It would be the medical model for 6 months, and then after that there would be therapeutic intervention. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky. I had private healthcare, and I was able to access those services by myself in the early stages when I needed it most. Because we do know that suicide ideation and additional problems such as alcohol and drug usage, dependency, can build up. But I suppose one of the other things was that if I could educate people on what this life experience is and what it has brought to me, maybe then they could take something from my real lived experience and something that would be tangible that they would remember and maybe think before they act on a road. I also know that I had very little support services other than those that I accessed. And I know that the loneliness that you can find in the aftermath when the funeral is over and all the callers stop calling, you're very much left alone to try and pick up the pieces of life.
And it even becomes more complex than that too, doesn't it, Debbie? Because you could be in a house full of people and, you know, a partner or someone else in the house could be dealing with things in a different way or working through it in a different way. So, you know, being on your own in a scenario like that, it doesn't necessarily mean you're physically on your own. And often, you know, when I'm speaking to, I'm not talking about you in this case, Debbie, but often speaking to parents in this area, often the people move at different paces or need different things. And we have to have stuff that firstly, in the first instance, is there, but also can adjust or accommodate, you know, people at different points.
Yeah. Well, we all grieve differently, no matter what the grief is. And we should be allowed that space to respect that space or that pace in how we grieve. And there's no right or wrong way to grieve. And it is very much dependent on the person. So you're right, in a room, everybody could be grieving, but they'll all be grieving in a very different way, and they'll be showing that grief in a very different way. And some people just find after such a traumatic loss that they just exist in life for a while. Sometimes many people just exist for a long, long time, and maybe forever for the rest of their lives. Where within life after, we really want to give people hope.
Yes.
And believe that we can build a life after this loss.
Yes.
It's a very different life. But it is a life that we can navigate through and we can feel supported through as well.
Yeah, and that support, as you say, just when you might need it. And for it's going to be different for each individual, but filling that gap, that huge gap, and a ton of emotions or no emotion or whatever that can make someone feel, you know, what's the point?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's just to ensure that it is there for as and when they need it, not when... I guess the medical model will dictate when you can have it and for how much you can have it. You know, there's no end game or garden or support services that we deliver.
There's more to life after than that, because it's a strange one, isn't it? You're inviting people, of course, to get in contact with life after, but it's not... It's a situation where we would never want to see the membership grow, really, because we'd want to avoid people finding themselves in this situation to begin with. It's a tough task, but one we can't give up on, and that's trying to, I suppose, reduce the amount of deaths on our roads, Debbie. And there is an element, a strong element of life after in terms of education and prevention.
Yeah. Well, as you just said there, we really don't want to be inviting people to join our membership. It's a unique club that nobody really wants that membership of. But unfortunately, it's necessary and it's needed for those families who find themselves in this situation. So the other part of life after is education on road safety and road user responsibility and prevention. And if we can go out and share from a lived experience, but also highlight the amazing emergency services that we have and what it is that they do and what the real life actions are happening on our roads, unfortunately, on a daily basis, then hopefully we can make people be much more aware.
But just in relation to that, like the likes of us here, we do a ton of road safety awareness. How do we bridge or close the gap between what we're talking about now, even the lived experience, Debbie, of having your beautiful son taken from you just at the beginning of his entire life? No one would ever want to go through that. And people are listening today going, God help that woman. I don't know what I would do if that was me. And there's unfortunately stories every day along the same line. We're trying really hard to get this road safety message across. We do our bit here with the guards and other agencies. But how do we bridge the gap? Because what we're seeing, unfortunately, is increased levels of drink driving, drug driving, non-wearing of seatbelts, speeding. So we're having amazing people like you telling their story through their own pain. And we have all this education as well, but it's not landing, or it's not landing in the numbers that it should be. I don't know how we get from point A to point B. Do you get me? It's frustrating.
Oh, absolutely. It is frustrating because we see now that how people behave on the roads are very different. Everybody's in a hurry. Everybody is wanting to get from A to B. We're really trying to put out, we have a new campaign starting now in the new year. We want you to drive to arrive. We want you to arrive safely. But a lot of this really is about respect of other road users. Mm-hmm. And we have to take it right back to that. You know, we always give off about tractors on the roads or cyclists or maybe pedestrians or whatever. But we all have a personal responsibility to mm-hmm. use that road. And that's the message that we're trying to put across to people, from the pedestrian to the cyclist to the vehicle user, yeah. to respect other people and not just be thinking of their own journey on that road as well.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, I just want, it's an element of the message I haven't seen done before, but I wonder, because we've tried everything else, would it help if we could find some way to message the time difference between being patient and safe and getting somewhere versus not driving like an idiot. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be 3 or 4 minutes on a 20-mile journey, right? It's tiny. So was that 3 or 4 minutes worth the gamble? I don't know. I don't know what the advertising campaign might be, but it just seems to be one area that we haven't tried that I wonder if that might get through to people. Because we've got great initiatives here in Donegal that started off here, in fact, and I think there's an element to that. It didn't start off here, but we adopted early here, where we get transition year students in, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them in, and we get very brave people who've been left paralysed from collisions, lost loved ones from collisions, something I want to talk to you as well about, supports as well, the emergency services that call to these collisions and what they have to go through. And they walk out in shock, in silence. The buses on the way home, I've been told by drivers, are deadly silent. Mm-hmm. But at some point that wears off. Very, very sadly, it seems. And it's not just younger drivers, by the way. I just want to be very clear
absolutely.
On that. But the reason you often focus on younger ones is because it's a new generation coming through and you kind of feel you're starting with a blank sheet, don't you? So there's lots going on. Again, I'm just frustrated that at some point getting there just that wee bit quicker seems to trump life.
Absolutely. And I hear what you're saying. Like, I've been involved with a project where I've delivered to over 400 young people in Buncrana last year. Again, you know, I can stand and I can talk about my story all day, but whenever I talk about just a normal mammy, you know, look, watching her son heading off for a crusty loaf of bread, and the next time I see him, he's in a body bag. That's my reality. And I share that with those people, and there is silence in the room no matter what age that person is. There is tears in that room. And what I do know is that I've had people come forward to me, you know, after hearing that, and have said, I'll never forget those words that you've shared.
Yeah.
And if that one person is the person that has taken that message, then that's going to be one person less that's going to be driving on the roads in a way that could cause a serious road traffic collision.
And that's why we never give up.
And that is it. We have to keep repeating this message over and over and over until finally people start listening. Unfortunately, our numbers are growing. You know, we had our launch on Friday of the road safety at Saturday. And there was 48 people had died at that. That was the statistic. Mm-hmm. But this is more than a statistic. This is people's lives. This is families' lives ruined. And they are grieving right now. Mm-hmm. That was 48 on Friday. We are now sitting at 52 people have died in Northern Ireland alone. So we've had four fatal road traffic collisions since that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's four more families who need that support. That is four more. And what we talk about is the ripple effect of that and the impact that that has to communities. Now, our aim is in the new year to go into communities. Yes, we start at that transition year, that 16, 17 years of age, because we want to educate those people. We want them to have their driving test, just like my son. We need the independence. We need to see that it's a fantastic skill to have. but we also have responsibility. But we also then need to go out to communities where we are going out to maybe older people, we're going out to people within community groups, youth groups, football groups, whatever, to again share this message mm-hmm. because we are all responsible.
Do you think through the licensing, the training and licensing process, enough is done to educate drivers to the reality of driving on the road? I've not heard your comments. This might actually come across as insensitive, don't get me wrong, but you just mm-hmm. mentioned black eyes and what have you. And at the moment, if the truth be told, at the moment, you do, you bang out your 10 lessons in the Republic, right? If you're in Donegal town, you drive round a roundabout once, you do a hill start, you do a three-point turn, and you reverse in around a corner, and shine, that's it. You've a licence, and that's you, ready to go on. Even if it's not relating to what your feelings might be personally, Debbie, do you think that we need to be doing more to ensure people are aware of, you know, like you can get a full licence here having never driven on a dual carriageway, never driven on a never driven at night, never driven in ice, never driven in snow, never driven in driving rain. Do we do enough?
I think you've definitely touched on something that's actually quite, I suppose, relevant to me because, you know, I live very rurally. I'm very aware of the dangers on our roads. Our son was very aware of the bends that he was negotiating round when that happened. But, you know, at no point, unfortunately for his dad or I, did we realise that there was black ice on the road that morning.
No, you wouldn't, exactly. It catches us out.
And, you know, and it could have been anybody, it could have been us. But I do believe that we need to educate more. I do think that personally, I think there should be a certain amount of lessons that you should be taking. I do think we should be learning to drive in the dark at night time, being aware of even oncoming lights. This is something, you know, my youngest has just passed her driving test. She passed it in the summer. The good thing, though, is she drove for a full year of lessons. The good thing is her driver instructor did take her out at night time.
Yeah.
You know, he did take her out when the weather wasn't great.
All right, okay.
These were areas that I specifically had fear over because of where we lived. So I know maybe in towns and maybe, you know, more built up areas, they wouldn't have that same experience on the roads. But here, the driver instructors that I've had with my children have been fantastic because I am much more heightened and aware and fearful this would happen again.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
I am also, because at the end of the day, you talk of the ripple effect. I'm also starting to find myself leaning towards boxes being in cars for newer drivers. And again, this isn't a focus on young drivers, right? But again, it's just what can change. Technology will sort this out in the long run. It's what happens between now and then and how many lives are lost between now and then. And I just do know that the black box, it knows what speed you're doing and it knows how you're cornering. And it's not going to save every life, but I'm just wondering at the point where how many more young people are we going to have to bury where that is a factor before we start saying, right, well, maybe it's something we need to look at. Do you need to be able to exceed the speed limit? Do you need to be able to corner hard? I don't know. But
I'm in agreement with you. And I know, again, my children have had those black boxes and they're really good because you can get a feedback from that device to tell you that, you know, you are maybe breaking too hard into corners. So there's where, right, let's see if we can get your score reduced down again, which is brilliant. But the thing is, we're targeting young drivers here. And we know, like, I have to hold my hands up. I am sure that I have many bad habits.
Me too,
as a driver.
I get you.
But but at the same time, there's nothing wrong when, you know, you reset, sit back. And, you know, I've done further. I've done the
advanced driver course now.
Advanced driver course. And I did that to educate myself, you know, to give myself a feeling of, I'm in control as best I can in this car, and I'm also watching. And as we know on the roads, we're always watching what other people are doing because that's what we have to be aware of. But we have no control over their actions on the road. We only have control of our own. So the black box, yes, I agree with it, but I also think that it's unfair sometimes that it's just young people
100%.
That have to avail, because we have people and we know that, you know, there's people who get penalty points and there are fines on their driving license repeatedly. Maybe that is somebody that needs to have a black
exactly.
box.
And the thing about Debbie is I'm trying to get, I'll be trying to get stuff over the line. Say, the reason why we don't have ID to prove that young people aren't being abused on the internet is because older people don't want to give up their ID to Twitter and to Facebook. That's just the truth. That's why we are allowing 12 and 13-year-olds on the internet to God knows what happens to them. It's because the 30 and 40 and 50-year-olds don't want to give up their ID to Elon Musk or whoever it might be. And that's why sort of in this road safety thing, I don't think we're going to get black boxes over the line for older people because no politician's going to touch it. That's why I kind of talked about young people in the clean slate because it's a new generation coming through. And I think me and you actually really are very much on the same page as this. Debbie, this is we're into
think
the,
of, yeah, sorry, go ahead. We think if we can educate from that very start of someone's driving experience, that we can if we can get that message across, then it will stay with them the majority of their lives.
Yeah.
You know, and that is why it's not that we target young people specifically, but that is definitely the area that we want to get in.
And young people are powerful. The reason seatbelt wearing became so universally accepted is because the young ones were coming out of school and saying, Dad, Mom, put your seatbelt on. So maybe younger drivers could start calling out the older drivers and be part of the solution. We're into the fourth year of the event that's taking place. Just remind us, if you don't mind, when, where and what people can expect, Debbie.
Okay, so the event is going to be run on the 11th of November, and this is the first year that we're doing it in partnership with the North West Road Safety Partnership, a newly formed group specifically highlighting road safety across, you know, Derry City, Instraban, Donegal, and into our Causeway Coast and Glens area. And so it is on the 11th. It's running from 11 till 3 in the Guildhall Square. There will be something for everybody there.
So just to be clear, sorry, I have November 16th as the date.
The 16th. Okay. The 16th of November. Sorry, apologies for that. 16th between 11 and 3 p.m. Our emergency services will do a reenactment of the work that they do when they come upon a scene. It can be hard-hitting, but that is the message. Yeah. You know, we need to show what actually happens, you know, in the event of a collision and how amazing that they work as well and how quickly that they get it to the person that needs that medical care. So it's really important that we highlight that.
Debbie, sorry if I kept you so long. There's so much to talk about there. I really appreciate your time, Debbie. Take care of yourself. And hopefully we'll speak again. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That is Debbie Mullen there, Chair of Life After. Right, tomorrow is Halloween, so no better time to get on the author of a new book. It's called Haunted Ireland. It's an atlas of ghost stories from every county, and it's Kieran Fanning who is the author. He's with us now. Kieran, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
Good, good. Congratulations on your book. Beautiful piece of work.
Thank you.
Easy to read. I like it. Black writing on a white background.
Yeah,
it's so, so refreshing. Talk to me about this book. It's been incredibly well put together. Of course, I'm sure it took an awful lot of work. Why ghosts?
Everybody likes a good ghost story, don't they? And I think kids especially do. And maybe it's something that's kind of fallen out of fashion. So we initially decided on a collection of ghost stories for kids. But when I began my research, I discovered that every county has a huge number of ghost stories. So then we came up with the idea of doing an atlas with a map so that you could conduct your own ghost tour of Ireland. And it seems to be going down well.
Yeah, because you didn't want just someone saying, I saw a ghost once. There has to be a story to it. That's part of the love of it, isn't it? You want to delve into the history, the background to it.
Absolutely, yeah. Like every county has supposedly haunted places. You know, oh, I saw a ghost in that castle, or people say that castle is haunted. But without the story, and the story had to sustain the reader for 3 or 4 pages. And so that was what helped me narrow it down.
You talked about getting stories from every county in Ireland. I think maybe there's a relationship, isn't there, between storytelling traditions and what part of the country you're from. Did you find certain areas were sort of rich in stories and others was more sparse?
Yes, the West Coast in particular was rich in stories. Places like Donegal, Kerry, Cork. Cork in particular, I think, had the most haunted tales. But I struggled a little bit with some of the eastern counties, even my own county of Wicklow. And I suppose there's lots of reasons for that. Maybe it's to do with the culture probably survived a little bit better in the West. Maybe it's to do with electrification coming later to the West.
Yeah, that's in and of itself, that throws up another interesting topic for discussion. Donegal is featured, Father Hegarty's Phantom Horse. Now, obviously, there's stories from all over the place, but obviously there's going to be more of an interest here in the Northwest. What can you tell us about this story?
Well, as soon as I heard this story, I said, that's the one for Donegal, and I actually stopped looking at further because I thought it was such a great story. So I came across a story by Ian Cullen in the Derry Journal in 2009, and it was about four boys who were out quad biking on the Inishowen Peninsula, and they were at night time and they were approaching the edge of the cliff when this phantom horse reared up in front of them and made them stop their bikes, and then the horse disappeared. And it kind of, the horse saved their lives, and a lot, it was at the exact spot that's called Father Hegarty's Rock. And a lot of people say that the horse belonged to Father Hegarty, and there's a whole story there about Father Hegarty, who was a priest in penal times. And priests, as you know, in penal times weren't allowed to practice mass. So he hid in the mountains in a cave and practiced in secret. And his sister brought him provisions, but his sister's husband was an English sympathizer. And he followed her one day to see where she was going with her basket of food. And he discovered the priest in hiding. And he turned the priest in to the authorities in exchange for a reward. And the next day, the Redcoats set out in search for Father Hegarty, but the locals provided the priest with a white horse to escape on. And he dashed off with the Redcoats, led by Captain Vaughan, following. And as he reached the water's edge, there was supposed to be a ferry there waiting to take him across the water. He jumped into the water, and Vaughan wanted Father Hegarty's head because he was going to get a reward and it would be proof that he had captured the priest. So Captain Vaughan shouted out to Father Hegarty, if you come back ashore, we'll save your life. And the priest, being as gullible as he was, believed the captain. But as soon as he swam on shore, Father Vaughan killed him. And his head was supposed to bounce three times on the rock that's now called Father Hegarty's Rock.
It's contemporary, that story, to obviously not the I mean the 2009 element of the story is contemporary.
Yeah, it's probably the most contemporary story in the book because it has that element of the modern connected with the past.
Yeah, and it's substantiated by more than one person as well.
Yeah, and I love all the stories that have that delve into the history. It kind of makes them feel more real, and it gives kind of context, and also maybe hopefully teaches the reader something new as well.
Do you believe you're telling stories of real experiences, or are they simply that stories? I suppose I'm asking, do you believe in ghosts?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't disbelieve and don't necessarily believe either, but I think they're fantastic stories and they have been passed along from generation to generation. And I don't think they should be forgotten. They've survived for a reason. I think every great story has elements of truth and also elements of lies in them.
Yeah, because, you know, the Father Hegarty story, there's a lot of background there. Some can be substantiated, other bits can't. And it's delightfully illustrated as well, that story, as all of they are, by Mark Hill.
Credit to him as well. Dublin illustrator, and his illustrations really suit the tone of the stories. They're kind of gothic and dark, and they're simple colours and stark outlines. It works really well, and Gil have done a fantastic job in producing the book. It's hardback and it's really a beautiful piece of art.
Yeah, you feel like you're buying something substantive. There's no doubt about that. Your favourite story is not the Donegal one, though. That went straight into the book. Meath, is it? Is your favourite story?
It possibly is Meath, because it's my own, where I'm living at the moment, and it's a fantastic, again, delving back into history. It's a story of the Norman conquest here, and a Norman's daughter who wasn't allowed to play with the locals. But being a teenager, she rebelled and she went out onto the lake, Loch Sheelan, which borders Meath and Cavan, and she met the local chieftain's son. And they fell in love and started seeing each other in secret. And that was all fine until the two families went to war. And Orwin, the boy, was called up and was killed. And poor Sabina, the girl, locked herself away in her father's tower and died. And the two of them died. And then the father was so distraught after it that he kind of made peace with the neighbouring enemies. And the two teenagers are buried standing up in a mound beside Ross Castle in Loch Sheelan, one facing Cavan and one facing Meath. And I think it's a fantastic story.
Wowzers. Okay. The book is published by Gill Books. Where is it available? Is it the usual answer?
Yeah, everywhere.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Yeah, and of course, we're speaking on the eve of Halloween, but it is it's an interesting book for any time of the year as well. And I think it... I think it's going to be broadly welcome, but I can even imagine an overseas audience that want to sort of get a sense of, you know, Irishness and what have you, and our history and our storytelling. Great stuff. I hope it's incredibly, continues to be incredibly successful for you, Kieran. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. All right, Kieran Fannin there. And the book is, and it's a pretty book, it's called Haunted Ireland. Do you know anything about that story in Buncrana? The story of Father Hegarty's phantom horse? Maybe you're one of the four. I'd love to chat to one of you. Or maybe you've got any other stories from around the region of your experiences with ghosts or stories that you've heard. Get in touch with us right now. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number, or you can call us on 074 91 25000. Do you believe in ghosts as well? P. Boner says, Professor Brian Cox to disprove the existence of ghosts. Scientists. You probably, I mean, I don't think you can disprove it. That's Brian Cox, formerly of Dream, isn't it? Is that the same guy who's in Dream or Erasure, I think? Anyway, that's not in any way to discredit his science. I'm just to find it a curious story. All right, it is the 9 till noon show, hour two, pretty much wrapped up. Get your ghost stories into us, even if you have knowledge of that story you heard Kieran reference there. News on the way too.